All right, well, let's start with a little bit of background information. Could you state your full name, please?
Donald Wearin.
And your date and place of birth?
August 11th, 1935, London, England.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe your educational background?
Well, I went to boarding school in Wales during the Second World War and came to North America as a boy, went to schools in New York, college in Montreal, graduate schools in the States, and then I've been here ever since I completed my graduate degree.
Where did you complete your graduate degree?
At Columbia in mm-hmm. New York.
Okay. Could you describe some of your research interests over the years?
My research, I would say, has been primarily in the area of religious education and values education.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been an ongoing interest, you know, right from the beginning. I haven't always, you know, been able to pursue it as much as I would like, but that's sort of a theme that's been running through, I would say, my years from the doctoral degree on. My dissertation had to do with interreligious relations in Dutch education and society.
Mm-hmm.
So I was into an aspect, at least, of religious education at that point, and that interest has not lapsed.
So when did you come to St. Mary's?
I came in September 1962.
62? And what was your position when you first came?
Well, I'm not sure what the rank was, whether I was a lecturer or assistant professor or what they called it. But anyway, I was a professor in the Faculty of Education. Oh, at the time it was called the School of Education. So to teach in the School of Education.
Mm-hmm. So, let's see. So the size of the university was a great deal different than it
is
today.
Yes, yeah. I'm not absolutely sure of the exact size, but I think it must have been in the 500 range, something in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how has the education department changed over all those years?
Well, we've become considerably bigger. I mean, at the time, I think we were about four professors, something on that order, and some part-time, but even, you know, the number of part-time helping us would have been, I don't know, perhaps three or four or something like that. So
mm-hmm.
it would be that small. The B-Ed classes when I first came here were, I think, somewhere as small as 14 or 15. I mean, I think they may have ranged up into the low 20s and so forth, but they were... The master's program was ongoing at the time. Rarely would there be a full-time student. It was just part-time, whereas now we have quite a contingent of full-time students. And the total numbers would have been quite modest. And compared to, I think, right now, formally proceeding towards degrees, we probably have... between 200 and 300, and I would guess that, you know, at the time, maybe we'd be talking about perhaps 25, 30, but anyway, it was small. I'm not sure of the exact numbers.
How was the curriculum different in the early years than the academic program?
Yeah. Well, in the B.Ed. program, there was less practical work than there is now. We had a month, an aggregate of a month in schools, or 4 weeks. I think it was split 2 weeks in the fall and 2 weeks in the spring. Whereas now we have double that. The students are in the school for 8 weeks, and they also go into school in September on what we call early school experience, which is not a full time, but each week, so let's say 5-6 hours in schools, observing what's going on, playing the role of teacher aide up to a point. And so in that sense, practical contact with the schools has gone up. We've also, at the time, there was an arts elective in education. People actually took one of their courses in the arts faculty, but since then, that's been dropped, and all our work is in the Faculty of Education. There's more work in methods than there used to be at the time. More has been added to the program. Not that much has been taken away from the program, which is one of the problems we're now facing, that we've got the same length. You know, it's basically a seven and a half month program. But more has been put into it. For instance, the province required a special course on special education.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of that has been added in. We've packed more in, but we haven't really taken much out.
So it's an intensive...
It's very, very intensive program.
Mm-hmm.
At the master's degree, I would say... perhaps our program has become a little more focused than it was then. I think it was perhaps broader in its content then. But I'm not sure that when you really come down to it, underlying the changes in titles and so forth, of course, is whether there is all that much difference. I mean, obviously the content has been updated, but I think it's still making people look critically at underlying issues in education, the things that really matter, you know, or at least trying to come to grips with those. And we have still courses in administration and supervision. Well, we had courses in those areas. I don't know if they were the exact courses we have now in terms of titles, but we had those courses at the time. So people were looking at the practicalities as well. It wasn't just theory. But I think you could say it was intended to try to come to grips with the important issues. One recent addition that's, you know, quite significant is the addition of the Teaching English as a Second Language Center, the TESOL Center downstairs in this building.
Mm-hmm.
And that has had quite an impact on the program, because now teachers can come and specialize in that area in their master's program. So that would be a very significant change. Through the addition of faculty over the years, of course, the master's offerings have been extended and expanded. I think what I said a moment ago relates perhaps more to the underlying concern that it look critically and fairly deeply at educational issues. But that can express itself in a diversity of ways. For instance, you know, we have had for a good many years now a colleague on faculty who is a specialist in science education. Well, when I started here, we didn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
We have colleagues with a special competence in the teaching of English, for instance. So those would be, I suppose, would make really for fairly significant expansions of at least the spread or the scope of the master's program.
Have requirements for entrance into the programs in the education department changed over the years?
Yes, I would say at the B.Ed. level, laterally in the last, you know, half dozen years or perhaps a bit longer, it's become a very competitive business. And I mean, people with, you know, fine records are being turned away. There just seems to be so much demand, and the number of places, while it's much greater than it was when I started, still is there's a ceiling on it. There's a quota. So let's say last year we had 56 B.Ed. students, but I think there would be close to 500 people bidding for those places. So you can get an idea of the competition. So, yeah, in that sense, the requirements have gone up. I had a feeling, though, that St. Mary's always was committed to some kind of sound academic standards in the admission of B.Ed. students. I mean, back in the days of, I may be mistaken, but it seems to me that in those days we said there should be a 70% average to gain admission, rather than a, you know, a mere pass or something like that. Now, whether we, how faithfully we stayed to that or how lax we became, that those are other questions. But I don't think there was a sense that education was simply an open door for anyone who, you know, who had an undergraduate degree.
Mm-hmm. What differences have you noticed in the student population itself over the 30 years?
In the student population?
In terms of gender, age, ethnic origin?
Well, you'd really have to look at the data for the, you know, the enrollment data to really, but I think, I mean, we definitely had women in the education, school of education when I came here. And see, one of the, even though it was an all-male institution, our classes operated at the end of the day. So they were officially evening classes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no reason to keep women from attending evening classes. So we had female students back in those early classes, both in the master's degree and in the B.Ed. degree.
What were the
proportions? Number this is, see, this, that to get that you'd really have to go and look, and the facts would speak better than my recollection. I'm taking a guess now, and I would say that the balance was favored males, that there were more males, that, you know, that it was not evenly balanced. Whereas now, in the B.Ed. program, you would have more females than males. So, the, you know, I suspect that's the reverse of what it was then. Mm-hmm. So we are gender imbalanced right now, but in favor of females at the B.Ed. level. At the master's, hard to say. I'm not sure what it would be. I would say it must be pretty well balanced now between the two. And at the time, though, there were definitely female students. So the proportions may have changed. The concept has not changed. The concept, at least in the School of Education, was both genders were, you know, equally entitled to pursue studies here and given, I think, equal treatment. And I don't think that's ever been an issue in education. For the rest of the university, of course, it was an issue because they had to get over the hurdle of, you know, how do you admit day students who are female when the policy was that it was basically a male institution.
Mm-hmm. So what changes did you see after 1968, after women were introduced to the day classes?
Well, you can see that it wouldn't have made a great difference, would it?
No.
Because we had them, they were part of the School of Education all along. Now, of course, what it would do, though, it might have contributed to the changing of the proportions as students, female students, went through the undergraduate programs. Well, that probably would increase the tendency for them to continue in a B.Ed. program here. So you had a maybe higher demands. And so in that sense, it was an impact. But in the day-to-day operation, I would say I can't think of any real impact that would have had.
So when you first came, it was a Jesuit-administered institution.
Yeah.
And in the 70s, it changed over and became secular. What changes did you notice, if any, in the institution?
Yeah. Well, I think I'd correct you a little bit on the use of the word secular. I think
public rendition.
See, I think basically I know what you're after, but secular in some uses of the term simply means an institution that avoids or bypasses or declares itself not interested in, or that it's whatever, things having to do with the religious aspects of people's education and so forth. And I don't think St. Mary's even now has gotten quite to that point. There are certain linkages with its background. I mean, just the act, the charter, still says, it's intended to give particular emphasis to the Christian values and tradition in higher education. That's in the charter. You might say, well, it's just rhetoric in the charter. But that's, I think, still has some guiding force. There is a, I think the role of the chaplaincy at St. Mary's is probably a bit different from the role of the chaplaincy at secular institutions and so forth. Now, nevertheless, in going public, I think St. Mary's has shown a continued or see, I'm guessing, but that the going public accelerated or confirmed certain trends that were already at work.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I think whether if St. Mary's had, let's say St. Mary's had not gone public, would it have retained the same kind of religious character that it had when I came here? I have some doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. It didn't happen that way, so that question can never really be answered. But I think there was a certain secularization process at work in society, in universities. As the university expanded, it had to, and there was an undersupply of university teachers in those years of the rapid expansion. So it perhaps had to be less attentive than it would have been under other circumstances to people's religious outlooks and so forth. And in other words, if they were seen to be competent, whatever it was, chemists or psychologists and so forth, well, they might be hired. Whereas in an earlier time, I think there would have been a closer look at what their own background was in terms of their attitude towards these the matters of the importance of religion and education and things of that kind.
Mm.
But even there, one has to be rather careful, because when I came to St. Mary's, there were already on staff, or at the very time I came on, there were people from other world religions, Hindu, Muslim, who were fully accepted as colleagues and fully welcome. So I don't think the university ever had a sort of a closed door policy or a very protective atmosphere. I don't think that, at least in my time here, I don't know about before my time, but I don't think that existed. But still, even I think the people of other faiths who joined the faculty came with the understanding what this was, chiefly catering to a Christian group and drawing from a Christian tradition or even a Catholic tradition. And that played itself out, so that in the early days, just to give you one example, the patronal feast day of the university, December 8th, was an important holiday which was celebrated with a liturgy And then I think we all had lunch together or some kind of a brunch. Or anyway, it was a festive day, mm-hmm. which was seen as important. After all, it was the name day of the university. But now that day is just a total zero as far as people stay home and they cram for their exams or whatever they do anything, but it doesn't have any real meaning. Now, sometimes some of us have made little attempts to try to revive something and have a gathering. We've had some nice gatherings, but we're talking about small groups getting together for a discussion or a liturgy and then maybe some food or whatever, but it's been a minor event, whereas before it was a university-wide thing. That's just one example, mm-hmm. and I could give you others. The practice, for instance, of opening classes with a prayer, that was quite standard when I came here. As far as I know, at least I was certainly encouraged to do that, and that's gone. You know, so there would be many changes in that regard.
Mm-hmm. When you were hired yourself, do you feel that you were examined in that way?
No, but I wasn't examined. But I think the references. I went to a Jesuit school in Montreal for my undergraduate degree.
Mm-hmm.
And the people there would have known the people here. So I'm pretty sure that, you know, Father Stewart must have talked at some point to some of my former teachers there. So there was a kind of an informal network. They would have been satisfied. But no, there was no examination that I was aware of in that regard. How it would have been with the non-Christians who were hired, you know, the Muslim, the Hindu, I suspect, I'm just guessing, but you'd have to talk to them. I suspect there would have been a chat with them to find out if they would be comfortable here and whether they could see themselves, you know, operating in an environment that was not their own, at least from a religious point of view, and maybe there would be some sort of meeting of minds. But as I say, at no point did I ever get a sense, either from them and or from myself, that, you know, St. Mary's was a place that I discriminated, let's say. In the bad sense of discriminative. I mean, I think it had to discriminate, otherwise it wouldn't have survived. It had to, you know, in picking the people who came here, but not in a narrow or a bigoted sense. I don't think that was part of the institution in my time, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the 1970s, a faculty unionization took place. What effects do you think that had at the school?
Yeah. Well, I mean, unionization was, in a sense, a confirmation of oppositions that were already there. It, you know, it didn't come out of the blue. In the years preceding unionization, there were faculty administration conflicts or tensions, and in a sense the unionization confirmed those and almost said, well, these are part of the reality, and we may as well structure them and enshrine them in a collective agreement and, you know, play it by the rules and act in accordance with the Labor Relations Board. In other words, it all became sort of regularized, legitimized, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I suppose in some ways that's good. I mean, if people are not going to get along in a kind of partnership, basis, well, then you better regulate the relationship in some way. So that's, so I don't see that the advent of unionization itself, you know, that was not, that itself did not make that much difference. But it, through this regularization that I've alluded to, it has, I think, maintained over, since it came in, maintained a relationship of, well, a certain adversarial relationship between the faculty and administration, so that, you know, there's a certain they, us, ethos, I suppose, and we live with it, and it diminishes or increases depending on the personnel involved. But I mean, it's there as the collective. A lot of the life of the institution does revolve around the collective agreement.
Mm-hmm. Through all the changes in size at the university, have you noticed any changes in the size of your particular classes and responsibilities?
There have been changes, but I think they've been cushioned in the case of education. In this sense that through the way work has been assigned and sections have been divided and all of this over the years, by and large, we have not been a faculty that has had sort of huge classes. There may have been particular years where people were combined in a single section and so forth, but over the longer Hall, I think you'd have to say that our class size has been probably 25 and under, that kind of class size. Now, as I say, this could have happened differently. It could have been that with the increase in numbers, in 1 year we had, had it confirmed the other day, we had about 160 full-time B.Ed. students. As I said a moment ago, now we have 50, 60 or so. So, you know, we had a very large group moving through. It could have been that in those bumper years, the decision would be, right, you've got 160, put them in a big room and, lecture to them in at least in a number of the subjects. But whether we ever had that in a given year, I can't recall exactly. But as I say, the prevailing pattern has been that no, that does not suit our objectives as a teacher training faculty, and we've got to get them down to smaller groups. So that's been the pattern of having a rough ceiling of somewhere in the 25 range. I mean, I've had classes in recent years with 30. There's one class where all the students are gathered together, and I taught it last year, and we had 56 in the class. So it isn't as though we don't have bigger classes. But if you're trying to look for your typical education class, it would not be, I would say, in excess of 25, 26, something like that.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel your relationship with your students has changed at all over time?
No, not really. When you come down to it, it's, I think that, you know, we went through the difficult years of the early 70s, where there was a more adversarial relationship with students, where students would where students really felt that they were disenfranchised and they needed more power and they wanted representation. And, I mean, there was one point where our faculty council, that's the the equivalent of a departmental meeting was 50% students, 50% faculty. In other words, the students were put on it. The number of students was adjusted or made equal to the number of faculty. I mean, that's just a little indicator of the kind of expectation that was there, and was there on the part of many faculty too. I mean, they didn't just march in and take over, but you know, faculty were thinking this is the democratic way of doing it, and so forth and so on. At times, I think the students were more adversarial than they are now, although even today you get, either it's a little group or sometimes a bigger group, and they say, you know, we're not satisfied with this or that. So I don't think that that when I say they were more adversarial in the early 70s, I don't think you can say that, they're just sheep now, far from it. But there was a period there where there was a greater consciousness of student power and so forth, and that I can recall some incidents where that was manifested.
Right. Okay. Have you noticed the difference in the students' family backgrounds or geographic origins over time?
We still have mainly Nova Scotian students. Although there I have to be a little careful. Back when I started here, I'm pretty sure we would have had exclusively Nova Scotian students in the BEd. Let's take the BEd. Whereas on and off in the last few years, sometimes there's been a considerable contingent of Ontario students, for instance. Now, partly that's due to the fact that they have a hard time getting into education programs in Ontario, so they look across the country and so forth and so on. So that has changed. I think this past year was a bit more back to the traditional one. But so has there been a change? I'd have to say yes. On reflection, mm-hmm. in the sense that there is a greater admixture of non-Nova Scotian students. But I'm not sure that that has really changed the predominant character of the student body. Likewise, in graduate programs, I mean, we have now a noticeable and contingent of foreign students, for instance, people from Africa or China or whatever. And numerically, again, compared to these hundreds of people taking master's programs, you'd say, gee, that's pretty small. In the alumni list, I looked at an alumni list. I had 1,000 names on it. There is a longer alumni list, but let's use that say that's a random sample. 4% recently had addresses outside Canada. Mm-hmm. So you're not talking about a big number. So that's the addresses of the alumni. And I don't know, 60 to 70% had addresses in Nova Scotia. So you can get a little bit of a sense from that. But yeah, there are more of the non-Nova Scotians there. Family background, I don't have a real feeling that there's that much change. I mean, we've got people of probably the spectrum of family backgrounds. Mm-hmm. I think we probably have more minority students than we had. I mean, we've had, this last year and the and two black students, and that would probably be typical in the B.Ed. class, two, three, something of that kind, for the last, maybe dozen years or something like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas in those very earliest days, I don't recall having one. Yet there was a, pretty sure there was a, a black lady who took the master's degree early on. Mm-hmm. And but probably if you were to follow that one up, you'd find it a shift as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, those are both the areas that I wanted to cover, unless you can think of any other changes over time or events that stand out in your mind.
No, I guess for me the big area of interest and to some degree concern is in the area of character education and values education that we've I think taken more of a hands-off policy on that. And you know, there's a lot of going back to the earliest years that I can recall, and I was not one of the Jesuits. I wasn't resident on campus. I hadn't been through residence life here, but you got the impression that, you know, residence life was monitored.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there were would be the pranks and the escapes and the windows open at night for someone to sneak in and out, and all of these sorts of things would go on. But the notion was there that somehow or other the university had some kind of responsibility to see that people behaved in certain ways. Or avoided certain types of behavior and what have you. And so that would be one way in which I think the university has, rightly or wrongly, I'm just describing now, has sort of stepped back and said, well, I mean, it has to be, things have to be pretty far-reaching before the university will step in and say, well, I'm sorry, we can't tolerate this.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot can go on in the in relation to drinking, sex, and what have you before the university will intervene in any way. So there's that. Another thing is, I think the university, even though it, I mentioned earlier on, I said no, it has not become a totally secular university, but I don't think it has done as much as it could have in supporting that charter item, you know, to give special emphasis to the Christian tradition and values in higher education. Mm-hmm. It's very tricky stuff because you're getting involved with potential charges of being discriminating in the bad sense and so forth. So it's easier in a way to step back from it. But I don't think we've had the focus on that. We have an Institute of Values on campus, which is, you know, one sign, I think, of an interest in that area. But I don't know that it has been sort of put on center stage and say, you know, here's something that is special about St. Mary's. This is St. Mary's education. Does this and that. It's very difficult, though, because there are many things going on campus and through campus that help people develop into caring and considerate and generous people, you know, projects to help this or that group. St. Mary's record with the handicapped is probably above average.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see it all negatively. I mean, these things have been going on, a greater respect, St. Mary's along with other institutions tries to show greater respect for women, and so there's so many things going on, but maybe the focus or the sense of you know, making this more explicit and clear, and maybe drawing on some kind of philosophical underpinnings for it. That's been, I think, weak. So that St. Mary's reflects now, if you will, many of the fine things that are going on in society, but I don't think it's making a unique contribution to say now, here is something that, drawing on our tradition, we can offer to this a point of view, an enrichment of it, a strengthening of it. That, I think, is, to me, and I know this is a personal view and you may not hear it from anybody else, but to me that's the disappointment of the last three decades, that has taken place. But all is not lost. There are lots of these other, you know, very good things going on, and you know, looking at it from someone with a particular faith perspective, I would, you know, say, you know, God is doing His work here, right through the piece, so that you can't second guess God. But humanly speaking, I would say, you know, there should be more emphasis. So I was on the committee on the future of the university some years ago, and I ended up having to give a minority report because I couldn't persuade my colleagues on the committee to highlight or to give some recognition to, or more recognition to, the area of values and how a religion might contribute to values and so forth. So I ended up issuing a short minority report, which was, I think, attached to the main report. I mean, that's symptomatic. I mean, these were all fine people of goodwill, handpicked people across the university, the 10 of them, the president, you know, these were people, I think, with St. Mary's interest at heart and everything. So I have, you know, a lot of respect for them. Mm-hmm. So it was curious that that's what the outcome was, that, you know, I was odd man out and, you know, had to take that route, which that I think perhaps is a good symbol or a symptom of what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great.
Yeah.